Thank you, Steph. And yeah, thank you to the whole organizing team for having me. Like, this conference is so awesome, and I am super grateful that I get to come back to Perimetre and talk to all of you. Yeah, when I was pondering what to talk about this year, I saw that there was a bunch of super nice talks about phase transition stuff and variational stuff already. So I decided to do something slightly different, something very applied, that has to do with embedding machine learning models productively into some contemporary engineered quantum materials experiments. And yeah, I am gonna tell you about two recent examples from my group where we did this, hopefully productively. So when I say the word engineered quantum materials, what I mean is a material that is sort of built in the lab from some basic components such that you don't observe your whatever phase transition, topological excitation, whatever you are looking for in like a native system where it's predicted to be, but you sort of like from a Lego pieces, you build up your thing in the lab, engineer the couplings to reproduce the Hamiltonian that you want to study, and then you see what you want to see. This has a super broad spectrum of different experimental realization. The image I have here as a background is just the superconducting resonators that are put on the chip in a way that they would create some interesting geometry with the interesting couplings. But it can be anything like exfoliating materials that you sandwich on the top of each other to modify band structure, or anything between these two sort of extremes. So there were two cool recent experiments that we were working with recently. One is an experimental realization of the Kitaev chain, and another one are a realization of the quantum dots in a bilayer graphene. Those were, for different reasons, these two experimental settings were challenging, and tuning and calibration was experimentally difficult, almost prohibitive. So those were the areas where we were trying to contribute. When I say tuning and calibration, what I mean on a really highest possible abstraction level is this, that if you have whatever quantum experiments, you have a lot of wires going into the fridge or a lot of electrodes or whatever, and you need to tune all your voltages, magnetic fields, any other control parameters that you have, such that whatever is happening inside your sample would correspond to the Hamiltonian that you are interested in. So in this sort of abstract view, you have a multi-parameter optimization problem where you need to connect some tuning parameters of your experiment to the underlying Hamiltonian. And usually you want to have this constant feedback. You don't want to spend a long time inferring which parameters you should try next and then reinitialize the experiment in 5 hours and start over. So in these settings, it's usually very productive to have some kind of very quick model that can do these predictions very quickly. And yeah, in sort of traditional settings, the neural network in this picture is actually a PhD student or a postdoc who spends many hours in the lab doing these things, and the goal for us is to replace that person with some machine learning model so they can spend their time more productively. If I now lower the level of abstraction a little bit to give some concrete examples, this tuning and calibration, again, there is a super many different realizations on what it means in this field. At the sort of super bottom level, you could have some kind of setting. This is a charge stability diagram of a quantum dot, and when you want to create a quantum state, one electron in one dot, one electron in the other dot, for example, you need to literally count these transitions and quickly arrive to that state. So the tuning in this kind of setting is literally just the image recognition problem. You are just looking in a measurement data for some features that you want to identify. sort of higher level problem, and those are the problems I'm gonna talk about today, are the ones where you are trying to map experimental data not just on some visual feature that you want to navigate, but you actually want to map it on a parameter of your Hamiltonian to, you know, learn or verify that the underlying physics that you think you're doing is the one that your experiment is realizing. So, very general formulation of this problem, we call it Hamiltonian learning, but you know, whatever. 5 years ago, people called it a quantum parameter estimation. But really what it is, that you have any kind of measurement data, it can be whatever, magnetization, charge, energy, conductance, anything really, and you wanna build some model that maps it reliably and preferably quickly and precisely on the parameters of your Hamiltonian. Of course, you can immediately tell me that I can never solve this in a full generality, so this is of course true, like we are aware that this is an exponentially hard problem and you cannot just like take measurements and fit precisely the Hamiltonian that you want in the space of all possible Hamiltonians. But of course in the field of this engineered metamaterials or engineered quantum experiments in general, you have pretty reasonable expectation of what's happening in your sample because you are really building everything from scratch. So actually we don't have to pick from all the Hamiltonians, we just have to pick from some and fit the parameters quickly. And that's really in the core of what I wanna talk about today. So I think now hopefully we understand the setup, so I can go back to these two examples. From a machine learning or a technique point of view, I will be talking about two different methods. These two particular examples were very nice for me because in the first one, I got to learn about conditional generative adversarial networks for a Hamiltonian fitting. And the second example with the bilayer graphene is an example where neural networks do like fine, but if you actually just do your good old optimizer that you customize a little bit, it's actually better. So I like this example that, you know, not everything has to be a neural network when you solve these types of problems. Okay, so let me get to the first example already, and that will be the Hamiltonian learning in this minimal Kitaev chain. This is a collaboration of my group with Aalto University and QTech at TU Delft. The lead author on this project is Ruven Koch, who is here at the conference and has an amazing poster. So I am going to slide over a lot of technical details and I'm giving this bigger picture talk. So if you are interested, please go talk to him and he will explain you all the details. So let me explain a little bit the setting that we are considering. So this is like a baby version of the Kitaev chain that you realize by coupling two quantum dots to a superconductor. For some experimental reasons, this has been really hard. It has to do with the spin polarization. I will not go into that. But in this kind of Kitaev chains, you can realize sort of two dominant regimes. And if you tune exactly in the middle of those regimes, you get a sweet spot where the states that you should realize are these topological Majorana states that people are very interested in finding. So the Kitaev Hamiltonian looks like this, and the two dominant parameters that have to do with the physics of this model are the so-called elastic cot annealing and Cross-Andreev reflection. They are both second-order processes, but basically the elastic cot annealing is just electron tunneling from the first dot into the second dot, and the Cross-Andreev reflection is the electron from the Cooper pair into superconductor reflecting from the electron here into the hole there. The interesting thing about this kind of physics is that these two processes have a different parity. I'm going to explain in a sec what it means. Then I will just quickly mention here that these two terms, they are just on-site energies. But basically, when you have a regime of your Hamiltonian that is dominated by this tunneling, the electron is just going from one dot to another and vice versa. So if you go from this corner of the diagram to this corner, you don't have any charge transitions, but you have a charge transitions in these other corners. And the Andreev reflection is exactly the opposite. So the Andreev dominated state has one kind of parity and the tunneling state has the other. And if you tune exactly that the amplitudes of both of these tunneling processes are comparable, you get this weird situation that you get this emerging mid-gap states for which if you would write the creation and annihilation operators and check all the commutation relations, you would get a Majorana-like state. So this is this kind of sweet spot mid-gap state that people want to see. Yeah. This is just the Kitaev basic Hamiltonian that we. I think maybe we need to talk in more detail afterwards because I think that this spin polarization actually takes care of it, but I need to think for a few minutes to answer this. So here, this is the kind of measurement data that you see here. You can simulate them directly with the S-matrix formalism, or this is just the conductance from the sample that you can directly measure. So this is something that is accessible both from the simulation point of view, relatively cheaply, and also in the experiment. So the task here now is really to take these measurement data and map them on the Hamiltonian as a ratio of this governing amplitudes, and figure out in which regime you are in, and quickly from your measurement data to map whether you need to move left or right to quickly tune your Hamiltonian into the sweet spot. Now, let me switch the gears a little bit and mention this conditional generative adversarial models. So how GANs normally work is that you are training some generator, sort of giving it some noise, and then you are feeding the real thing into the discriminator, and then the goal is to fool the discriminator such that it cannot recognize what is the generated image and what is the correct image. So we do this kind of training procedure here. This conditional part here is really just that you also feed your Hamiltonian parameters. So your discriminator is giving you probability, fake or real, conditioned on a specific Hamiltonian parameter. Then when you finish your training, you can give the experimental data and the grid of the parameters on which you define to discretize your Hamiltonian. And then you can plot the confidence of the discriminator. This is the correct sample that corresponds to this Hamiltonian parameter. as a function of that Hamiltonian parameter. So this may sound like a little bit convoluted strategy of doing this, but the big advantage and the useful thing here is that with this conditioning, you can always plot your distribution. So it's not like that if you would just consider like a feedforward neural network, you get a mapping on a particular parameter, but you can do, of course, some statistics to have a, you know, confidence, but especially in the cases where you have a maybe two underlying parameters that would correspond to the same measurement outcome, this gets kind of lost. But here you can sort of reconstruct these underlying distributions and really see what's your most likely parameter and what's the gradient around it. So it sort of gives you more confidence in this estimation. So this is not important for the Hamiltonian learning part, but just to show, this is the example of our generated images next to the experimental measurements of this differential conductance. And yeah, okay, so the generator did pretty good. When we show it to the experimentalists without a label, it's hard to tell for them. So that was for us a sign that we are doing something correct. But more importantly, if we look at the discriminator confidence for each parameter ratio, we get this type of plots in these three different regimes, the tunneling dominated, Andreev reflection dominated, and the sweet spot. So here, because this was done on a simulated data, so we can check the theoretical line is the green one, and our prediction is the dashed violet one. So you see, it's not always perfect, because especially in this Andreev dominated regime, The gradient here is a little bit flat, but this is the type of plots that you can get from this conditional GANs. So we did statistics on this kind of measurements. This is a statistics over 10,000 samples, and the accuracy to be in a correct regime when we define some sort of tolerance value around the sweet spot was about 97% on the simulated data. So now, with this in mind, we moved to the experimental data. Now there is the important point here, and yeah, this comes a bit back to your question, is that the physics of the actual device might be different, right? Like, I can write the Kitaev Hamiltonian from the original paper as much as I like, and I can trust that our experimental partners figured out how to deal with all the redundant effects that they do not want. But still, yeah, you can, this discrepancy is sort of inherent. So it's not guaranteed that if you train on a simple toy model, which in this particular case, this was like the simplest description available of this kind of system, and map it on the experiment, you are actually going to get the correct thing. So these are two different experimental data sets in two separate magnetic fields. And so you see that this is what was predicted by the GAN, and this is what was predicted by the experimentalists. Here I don't want to go to the detail, but you can basically introduce bias in your experiment such that you are sure that whatever conductance you're measuring in one setting is only Andreev, in the other setting it's only tunneling, then you divide the two and you get some number with some tolerance. So this is where this big sort of horizontal error bars are coming from. And so what you want is that the GAN and the experiment would agree with each other. Here we are in the uncharted territory. We don't know what's the underlying truth, but we know what our model predicted and we know what experimentalists tell us. And so you see that we are sort of following this trend. There is an interesting, these three red points, which was the points where actually Alberto and David mislabeled the sample, like using the experimental procedure, but the GAN predicted it correctly. So we have already a few examples where the accuracy of being in the correct regime on the of the neural network is higher than the trained expert. On the second sample, the accuracy is a little bit low. There is a bunch of these other colored points where the noise in the data was so hard that neither the GAN or the experimentalists were able to say either way. But overall, it was really good to see that if you sort of in the cases where you can really plot this squared images of the conductance, you can see the parity of the avoided crossing visually. And it seems that this is indeed what the neural network here has learned to recognize. So this was an example of this sensitive topological mid-gap mode that people want to engineer, and having the correct parameters is crucial. And it seems that this kind of Hamiltonian learning mechanism can really help with the tuning part. In this project, Ruben can talk more about that, we are going beyond just Hamiltonian learning. Right now, these pre-trained neural networks, they take like a super quick time to evaluate. So we are really now running a continuous real-time runs on the device where the neural network is deciding where to shift the control parameters. Okay. Maybe do we have questions for this first part? Yeah. Yeah. So is this S matrix formalism, and then you write the G function, and then you write add the Fermi-Dirac distribution on top of
that. But the model is just one side plus the lead, or?
Again?
In the model, what do you have? How many parameters do you have, for instance, in the
model? This is just a single particle.
No, sure, but it's 1D, it's 0D, how do you treat the leads? What is the Hamiltonian of the model?
Oh, I don't have a, let me see if I have, I don't have an extra slide for this. Can I just walk you to the poster afterwards and we talk? Let me see if I can. I think we are not gonna see super clearly, but it's just this, yeah. You have the tight binding Hamiltonian, and you write a S matrix using some knowledge about tunneling to the leads, and then you can write this differential conductance function, and then add some thermal effects on top of that. Yeah.
Thank you. So regarding this last, like next steps about the shift of parameters, do you have any way of validating the result in a sense? Maybe when you shift the parameter, you get some resonance in your, or like. So when your machine tells the experimentalist to shift the parameters, do you see that the result is better, therefore the shift was needed? Do you have any way of like validating this result, or unless it's just ongoing work? So
yeah, so I think you can sort of, actually you are asking super deep question that is in the core of all of this discussions with the topological modes, right? Because with any kind of transport measurements, you have an evidence, but you don't know is the mode. But in this particular setting, there is this visual evidence where you wanna the avoided crossing like merge into each other, so you will qualitatively see this mode.
Okay, so
mode
basically push into the sweet spot, and then when you shift, you should see this emerging.
Exactly.
And if it's
exactly
correct, then okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So you wanna continuously do this, and of course you can do this like by a human method, but then you have to every time print these measurements and look at them. Yeah.
Could you repeat what goes into the generator?
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
So in the generator, what goes in as input?
So into the generator goes the normal, you just start with some like a noisy data.
Okay.
And so it's a normal GAN setup where you have in the training, you are comparing the noise generator with the
strict attention in this talk
with the simulated data.
Theories for which the number of representations which appear in this decomposition is finite. So I'm going to call that number.
And then you have as extra input this condition. So for each input comes with its Hamiltonian parameter. So you would have this is conditioned on the value x of the delta over t ratio. So it's just the standard generator, except that you have this extra Hamiltonian input.
Okay.
Let's move on to the other example. This has to do with the bilayer graphene. Actually, can you give me a heads up who knows like what quantum dots are? Okay, good, almost everyone. So you know that normally quantum dots are these degree of freedom. For example, electron that is confined in all the spatial directions, and people are like, okay, then I can use the charge or spin on this to do quantum computing. And there is a lot of standard implementations using silicon or gallium arsenide, things like that. But sort of a new idea in the field was the fact that you can open the gap in the bilayer graphene using external fields. And then if you modulate the gap opening, you can reproduce this quantum dot kind of setting. And because graphene has a lot of these good properties that should decrease the overall noise of the qubits, it's something that people are studying. So this is the project that we did together with Josef Chiao and Rebecca at ETH and Frank at MIT. And indeed, it's a similar Hamiltonian problem. A description of this, as you know, there is a whole conference about this. I am no huge expert on graphene, but yeah, there is a lot of open questions from a theoretical description. So again, you want to make some quantum dots in the materials where maybe you do not understand all the physics, but you would like to be able to fit some Hamiltonian and confirm that maybe the states you are populating are the interesting states that you think you have. This is just the quick illustration of this thing that I mentioned. I will not go to the details, but yeah, smart people at ETH were able to solve all the fabrication challenges, so you could basically use the gates like in a normal quantum dots to modulate the gap, and you get this kind of nice Coulomb diamonds that you usually see in a quantum dot experiment. This corresponds to the electron occupation, and if you cross to the next one, you have a more electrons and so on. So the first experiments on this were done at ETH in 2018, and at that time the best experimental fit of when you are measuring the energy as a function of perpendicular magnetic field was this. So it's a bit, and that was super good at the time, but then it's sort of, do you actually know which state you have? And this was really the question that we were asked, if we can solve this problem, yeah, and find some description that fits better. There is a super super simple Hamiltonian description. It's the same is the same situation as before. Nobody is trying to describe the device on some kind of microscopic level, but this is work of Guido Burkhardt. You can find some simple toy models that is just a few parameter problem. In this case, the key parameters when you reduce this description is that you just have a potential that confines your quantum dot, the potential that controls your gap, the valley number in graphene, and the angular momentum of your wave function. So we forget about the details of the Hamiltonian, and the whole story continues the same way like with the previous examples. We get some measurement data that are transport measurements of the frequency as a function of the magnetic field, and we want to find the potentials and the quantum numbers that these states correspond to. So just a theory side comment. If you take that Hamiltonian and do the thing where you put the solution inside of the dot and outside of the dot to be continuous, and it's a sort of compact description, you can reduce it to some determinant problem. And if you plot these determinants, you get some kind of density plots like this. The color is just really value of the determinant of the matrix that you are trying to solve. And these lines that you see here, that correspond to the measurable energies. In the experiment, you can just measure the frequency that you have and not all the gradient around it. But we generated a bunch of these determinants, and just applying a t-SNE gave us these super beautiful clusters where each cluster already corresponds to the correct combination of the valley number and angular momenta of the wave function. So I was like, yay, okay, this was easy to solve. We are done. So in practice, it actually wasn't, because if you don't have all of this density gradient profile around the energy that you are measuring, no matter how sophisticated clustering method you try, and we tried a lot, you just get some mess. So this was a fun thing to understand about how limited is the information that you actually get from the experimental data. So but in the end, it could be a simple problem, because you just have a lot of these data points that tells you frequency as a function of the magnetic field, and then you just need to fit four parameters. So we said that we can try to fit them. So you have these two continuous potentials. I will just remind, one that confines the dot and one that modulates the gap size. And so you could fit them, but it was kind of, this problem specifically was kind of annoying, because if you plot the loss of the problem as a function of these two potentials, you get this super shallow minima in the middle. And so here the white square is the correct solution, but it's really tricky to solve something like this with the gradient thing. And then you could do some global optimization, but that's very computationally demanding, of course. So what we did is actually like a really, really, really simple solution. So first, because we have this Hamiltonian that I written down on some previous slide, we can actually calculate the gradients from the Hamiltonian and just find where this shallow valley is using a gradient method. I will just quickly mention this. You can just use Hellman-Feynman theorem, because the loss function that you are trying to optimize, you can just rewrite it as a function of your energy. And the Hellman-Feynman theorem tells you that differentiating energy is the same as derivative of your Hamiltonian with the same parameter, and then calculating expectation value to your wave function. So we can calculate, don't worry about all this integral and stuff, like the important thing here, that we can really calculate the derivative of the wave function with respect to the parameter that we are interested in directly from the Hamiltonian. So then each step in your gradient profile is just a geometric sum of these two of these two derivatives. So that made this gradient optimization like infinitely cheap numerically. And when you do that, when you know where this valley is, then you can just do global method in this very targeted space. So then your initialization is way, way cheaper. In this case, we use the control random search. And on a simulated data, we had a precision of these two potential fittings as around 0.2%, and we managed to find these discrete quantum numbers in 100% of the cases. So that was good to see. And again, running these algorithms wasn't super, super expensive. And now, again, if we move to the experiment, what's a reality? Nobody knows, but at least our fits are sort of following the general trends of where the lines go now in this setting. So we were sort of able to identify sort of the at each magnetic field this ladder of the states that appear and assign them specific quantum numbers. So we did this over three different data sets from a different samples. You see that some are better than others, but overall we are able to, at least at the low energy specifically, distinguish those states rather precisely. So the bottom line here was that even if the Hamiltonian fitting problem seems hopeless in the overall explosive like dimensionality of your optimization space with this a simple trick of dividing it into the global and local and separating the continuous and discrete parameter fitting, we were able to narrow it down and get a pretty good results and led to some improvement in understanding of what kind of states you can get. So Just to finish up, I wanted to give a little bit of perspective on this kind of work, because there is a way of looking at this that you can just say, okay, this is some boring service project to the experimentalist, right? And that's of course a valid point, but at the same time, I feel it's really interesting to think about how we can bring theory and experiment closer and really like working together, that we are not just working separately and then try to understand what the other person did. And it was also interesting to see that even these toy models that we see just from the description, that they are super limiting and we are neglecting a lot of effects compared to what's actually going on in actual material samples. But with this generalization power of ML and whatnot, they can be actually immediately experimentally useful, which at least in the case of this Kitaev model, because it's so difficult to implement experimentally, that was a big surprise for me. And yeah, so I really like to think in these terms of, yeah, thinking about experimental and theory collaboration differently, and I think that this kind of projects are a useful example of that. And I want to thank to my whole group for their amazing work. Again, go talk to Ruben about the Kitaev stuff. Josef is not here because astrophysics stole him from us for a PhD, but then you can ask me about the bilayer graphene stuff. Thanks for listening.
Thanks a lot, Eliska. Do we have questions? Oh, there's the first.
At some point, you made a statement. It's annoying to analyze the data. So it means machine doesn't get annoyed. It's very patient and it does detailed analysis. So it's very fascinating, you know, how you can accurately determine the model parameters from a mess of data, because you showed the curve, the Coulomb diamonds and so on. For any human being to analyze it in great detail is very difficult. Is that the message you want to convey?
Sorry, can you repeat the last no. point?
So I have a set of data, mm-hmm. and I have the standard way of analyzing it,
yeah.
and getting parameter fit. And it's very annoying. So whereas when you feed it to the machine and train it, it does a good job without getting annoyed. Sorry.
Yeah, no, actually, I think there is a this is actually such a great point, right? Because I jokefully say that it's annoying, but actually what it is, it's a real scaling problem in a contemporary experiments, because it was like nice teachable task if you had a one quantum dot. But nowadays, if you have a two-dimensional arrays of 20 with million voltages that you need to optimize, it's not actually practical to have a human doing that over 8 months with all the human systematic errors that come into that. And of course, the human expertise is still needed, because you can train your machine learning model in a wrong way and then go to the wrong corner of your landscape, and it's the human expertise that recognizes this. But overall, it's really this scaling problem that is in the core of this. Yeah, thank you for this question.
I follow up on that. So I see many like control problems in quantum computing that seem to be exponentially scaling. Do we need breakthroughs in AI to solve that scaling problem, or do you think the current generations of AI are sufficient with their generalization capabilities?
Oh, that's a good question. So I think that is, yeah, I think it's something that's like a long-term goal for me. I still feel that like our field is not working with the computer science like productively enough, right? Like we are always like 2 years behind whatever was the coolest new ICML paper. And I think actually deploying this like really large scale language models on this kind of tuning problems is something that should really reach the level of complexity that we are looking for, but just mapping those two problems on each other is kind of hard. So my prediction would be that probably it should be fine, because the AI research is also a little bit ahead of us, but yeah, we have to see. But we see how powerful these transformers are, right? So probably if it can solve quantum physics homework, it can probably fit a large multi-parameter problem, right?
Have LLMs been used yet for any calibration problems, like in experiments that you know of?
To my knowledge, no.
Thank you. So the question is, you showed a slide about GANs and making predictions about observations that haven't yet been seen by human researchers. Is there a machine learning interpretability method that you can use to actually ask again, why did it make the decision that it did, or some methods to say what features is it looking at, or maybe even come up with a mathematical expression for some sort of order parameter that kind of makes it classify a phase the way it does? Because I imagine if you had two students disagreeing with each other, you would just ask them, why did you choose one phase and why did you choose the other, and they would tell you, and you would make a decision at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, like, yeah, as you know, this is a burning question in the field. So my answer is the usual one. Like right now, the GAN, I actually didn't talk about it. The setup of the generator and discriminator is a standard CNN, which means that beyond some filter function, whatever calculation, your interpretability is somewhat limited. I imagine that replacing it with some kind of transformer when you have a little bit more correlations that you can understand would be probably a good idea to analyze this kind of. Yeah, I think in this sense is not unlike any kind of, qualitatively any kind of problem when you are trying to map data on some physical quantity. So indeed, this is a big open question. Yeah.
Do you have more questions here or online?
I write a question in questions and answer in Zoom program software. Yeah.
Okay, I'm having super hard time understanding, so
I ask about if we could use machine learning to answer about unpredictable physical question like the destiny of our universe or not.
Did you understand that?
So we have a lot of background noise here, and it's really pretty impossible to understand the question, unfortunately.
Please, if I could ask my question, please permit to me.
Okay, you can try it now again. Give it one more try.
I ask about if we could use machine learning to answer about unpredictable physical questions like the destiny of our universe or not.
Yeah, I think there is a bunch of, like, you know, more philosophical papers about that. Space-time is a neural network predicting things, so I guess there is some people thinking about that, but I am not an expert on these questions.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Yeah. You have one here.
Could you go back to your last slide or the one before? No, the one before. Yes. So when you did this prediction, essentially, how many? So essentially, you have one slope on one point per level. How many levels could you predict, and how many parameters did you need? So could you assess a bit predictive power of the overall model?
So these are. So you see that we are sort of, if we count for the splitting, these are sort of the three lowest excited state, and per each of them we have a four parameters. So, and for each of the states we need to find a continuous point in this UV landscape and then rerun that simulations for all the possible combinations of a quantum number. So at some point we cut off the total number of quantum numbers we are trying to, like, some 16, because if you go higher in frequency, the measurements get so messed up. It's not very clear what you're fitting.
But you use the same parameters for each level, or different parameters for each level?
You use same as in UV tau m. You are fitting them per level, four, but they will have a different value per level.
So you have four parameters, but just only two outputs. So it's totally ill-conditioned, right?
What do you mean by two outputs?
Each level, you only have essentially the slope on the position of the... So you have your Cramer pair, and then you have its position on the splitting.
Oh, yeah, sorry. So, of course, these visualizations are always going to be incomplete. What this image does not show are the actual gapping and confining voltage for that problem that you need to find. So those are these control parameters that we adjust, and the outcome here are the two quantum numbers. So it's a four parameters in total. Am I answering your question?
Not entirely, but okay, I understood better.
Okay.
One quick question for part one. So you used GANs based on CNN, and I guess you started with CNN first and it failed, and then you used GAN, or you were, you know, or...
I don't have a backup slide for this, but indeed you can just use a feed-forward network, and the classification accuracy is fine, but lower than for the GANs, plus you don't have this distribution, so the reliability of the prediction is questionable. Basically, the CNNs do, like, super brilliantly when you are firmly in one or the other phase, but once you are getting closer and closer to the sweet spot, the predictions get bad.
And can you make any use of the generated images, or it's just, like...
In this particular case, no, not really. Like, here, it's really like the new idea is to really use the discriminator in this kind of model. Yeah.
besides checking that the experimentalist was like happy with it.
Yeah, exactly. That's how we use it. That we show it and we ask them to tell us if it looks correct. Yeah.
Have you seen any cases where your generator gave you very stupid, not experimentally looking images, and then it was some. I mean, did you have a badly trained gun that had ugly images, maybe? And this is like additional way of validating your guns make sense.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that Ruwan can give a better answer to this. We definitely saw some pathological cases. I cannot remember an example where the measurement plot would be horrible and the parameter prediction would be correct. But
So regarding the GAN, so what was the that would I just came through the archive paper, and so it was trained for 40 epochs. What was your criteria to stop the GAN? And another question is that related to the previous question. So you use also MSC to train the generator, right?
Yeah.
And that's unusual. Like, why did you use on top of using the typical loss function? Why did you also use like MSC on the output of the generator? Because I imagine that would sort of constrain the expressivity of your generator.
This is the same question, because then what do you do about interpretability? Because if you don't constrain the generator to generate something that looks like a measurement, how do I ever check that this is super deep question, because maybe you have there is an underlying effective theory that does not produce the measurements whatsoever, but happens to predict the correct parameters. But we didn't do it for the reason to have this constant experimental feedback to know that the generator is actually feeding something that looks like the real measurement. Yeah.
I see.
But this is an interesting question.
And so about the number of epochs for training, what was the criteria to stop there?
The huge trial and error, like when the generator looks reasonable and the discriminator error is low, then we stop. Yeah.
Okay. So if there are no further questions, then let's thank Eliska again.